One of the best things about learning two ways to live is that you know what it's about? It's actually about grace. And it's okay if you forget some of the aspects. What matters is that each and every one of us actually seeks to keep growing. If you're a Christian, you seek growing in how it is that you would explain the message of Jesus to other people. So now, we've got this slide up here which has, you know, the six pictures, but you'll notice it doesn't have the verses on it. Now, can someone shout out, what's the verse for the first box? Revelation 4:11, yep. And then the second box? Isaiah 53:6a, right, A, right there. The third box? Hebrews 9:27, yep. Box 4? 53:6, A and B, right? The whole thing, all right? And then box 5? 1 Peter 1:3, and then box 6? John 3:36. Now, friends, one of the big reasons why we gather here at Forum is not so that we just remember pictures and numbers and words with it. It's so that we can actually explore the logic of what's going on here. Because we want you, and we want everyone, to be able to know not only two ways to live, but the Christ of two ways to live. Tonight we've got a really important topic we're going to be thinking about. We're going to be thinking about this question that you have on the front of your outlines. Is colonization an intergenerational sin? And to get us thinking a bit about this, what I want to do is I just want to invite Gloria up to help us think through a particular question. Now, if you haven't been here with us the last few weeks in the book of Romans, this is actually an opportunity to just get a bit of a recap of some of the things we've seen. But for those who have been here, I guess a question that we should think about is, based on everything we've seen in Romans so far, is justice individual or is it communal? Can judgment accurately be dished out on a group, or is culpability for your wrongs something that is personal to the individual only? Well, Gloria is going to come up and help us think a bit about that.
Great, thanks, James. Here we go. So previously in Romans, so I think as we look at it, we see that actually justice is something that seems to be discussed in quite personal terms. In Romans chapter 2, we see that Paul explains how each person will face God's judgment when Jesus returns to judge the whole world in the future. And so in verse 6, Paul says that he will render to each one according to his works. So God is going to make sure that every person receives the appropriate judgment or justice for what they have done. He's going to do this because God is going to judge the secrets that are in the hearts of mankind. So even if nobody else knows about it, God knows. He knows what is in people's hearts. And this is going to happen through Jesus. And every human is going to answer to God for what they have done, regardless of what nation they have come from, whether they are from a Jewish background or a Greek background or any other background. What's more, even though the Jewish people were saved by God and were given laws to live as God's people in light of that, each individual Jewish person was not saved just because they were of Jewish descent or by keeping certain rules and laws about circumcision, for example. Instead, we see that for no one is a Jew who is merely one outwardly, nor is circumcision outward and physical. But a Jew is one inwardly, and circumcision is a matter of the heart, by the spirit, not the letter. His praise is not from man, but from God. And so we see that God was seeking each of these people, each Jew, to be a Jew, not just because he was born into that sort of group, but he actually wanted each of them to individually have hearts that were changed or circumcised. This concept is not a new one, and it echoes what was spoken by the prophet Ezekiel hundreds of years earlier. He explains that each person will be accountable for their own wrongdoing, not the wrongdoing of someone else, even someone as close to them as their parent or their child. And so they'll be responsible for their wrongdoing or sin or iniquity. And so we're going to see that in this verse coming up now. The soul who sins shall die. The son shall not suffer for the iniquity of the father, nor the Father suffer for the iniquity of the Son. The righteousness of the righteous shall be upon himself, and the wickedness of the wicked shall be upon himself. And so as we see, as we've looked at some of these passages from Romans, and as we've looked at it from here in Ezekiel as well, there's a really strong sense that actually each person will be the one to answer for their own sins, not for the sins of someone else, even someone as close to them as a family member. Thanks.
I've come to talk about the HSC, or the IB if you did that, or whatever exams you finished at school. I've got a big question for you. That is, what factors determine the difference? You know, I've got HSC results there, but yeah, IB results or year 10, whatever result. What are the factors that determine the differences in your end of schooling examinations? There you go, there's a nice little conversation. We all know something about the end of school examinations. We all know we've been cheated. So just speak freely with each other on the subject. This is one of those questions that can go all night, can't it? Because there's just more and more. So why don't we just collect up some corporately? Yes? Your rank. How did you get a better rank or a worse rank? How did you score better on the tests?
Because you were either knew more or you were luckier than the other.
How did you get to know more?
Because they
natural instinct.
Natural instinct, that'll do, thank you. Good. The culture of the school?
Genetics.
And how you're taught? Economic status? If you studied in New South Wales versus Queensland, the competition's different. Factors contribute, they don't determine. Okay. Your motivation? The personal interest you have, yes. How effective is your study pattern, your study methods and the like, yes. Teachers, yes.
How well your fellow students at school did.
Yes, how well your fellow students at school did. Yes, the schools that have very few high-ranking students do not push on like the ones who do. Yes.
Friends,
yes.
How busy you are.
Mental health. Sorry? Asians. Is this a polite way of saying genetic difference, or is this a way of saying, sorry, mixture, or is it, are you talking about how much extra school coaching? What race you are, yes, okay. Whoa. Cool, yes. The subjects you choose, yes. Hard work. The school you're in, yes. Certain schools get better results than others. And I've got most of the groups down here, but for the sake of the terrible thing, the Queenslander, yes. What you ate for breakfast, yes. There's a personal testimony there in that one, isn't there? There's a whole host of factors, isn't there? One of the ones you didn't mention is which sex you are. Didn't mention that, did you? Actually, boys do worse than girls at the end of the HS, at the end of school exams, which partly explains why 60% of university students are now women. Of course, the results are different. It's got to do with maturity levels, which is affected with gender again. But it's not singular. It's a whole range of these. There are factors behind what is happening, isn't there? Let's move it a little bit further. You see, what areas of life do children of intact families do better than those of broken families? I raise it because one of the key indicators of academic success is family background. It's quite extraordinary. I mean, all these other factors are factors as well. And so it's not like as if there's just one thing. There's a whole range of things. But one of the highest correlations between academic success and all the other factors going, family background. How much your family's into education, whether there are books in your home, how much screen time you're allowed as a child, whether mum and dad are still combined together. So just answer, what areas of life do children of intact families do better than those of broken families? And I'm not talking about education now. Anything else? Well, here's some of the lists that you're going to have. Children of families that are intact, mum and dad, married still, do better in wealth, health, education and employment as adults. And as teenagers and adults, they do worse in mental health, drug and alcohol abuse, marriage and family life. The divorce breeds divorce across generations. They have a higher suicide rate, a greater crime and delinquency rate, and they are themselves involved in more domestic violence, both as children receiving it. One of the most dangerous person that you will ever come across is your stepfather, and also in perpetuating it themselves as adult. There's not a good list there, is there? Now, I need to make something very clear at this point. If you come from a family that's divided by divorce, and this number of people, there's bound to be someone here, isn't it? You've been raised by a single mother for whatever reason it may be. That is no indication that any of this is true for you. You've got to remember, generalities that come from statistics are not the same as individual case studies. Some of the best mothers that have ever walked the face of the earth are, for various reasons, single mothers, and in fact need all the more praise because they've been able to do such a great job as single mothers. But in general, single mothers are the second poorest group in Australia. Indigenous Australians are the poorest. Single mothers are the second poorest. You might have a single mother who's filthy rich because of inheritance. I mean, there's individual differences, aren't there? But in general, these things are true. That the intact family has enormous advantages. Even so, the married intact as opposed to the cohabiting intact. And you say, well, Philip, that fits your prejudices. How do you know it's true? Well, there are a number of books on the subject that are fairly easy to pick up. Why Marriage Matters is a book that comes out every 5 or 6 years from about 30 or so American sociologists, economists and the like, who keep monitoring the statistics across America on the subject. One of the key men behind it is Professor Brad Wilcox, who, unlike all the others, is a Christian and is professor, I've forgotten where, it's the East Coast somewhere, Virginia or somewhere like that. He's now put a book out saying, Get Married, Why Americans Must Defy the Elites and Forge Strong Families and Save Civilization, because the statistics are just so overwhelmingly bad for people not getting married and having children and raising children in that context. And so he's on a campaign about it as such. Now, of course, that's America, but it's also true in Australia. Here's a book by Kevin Andrews, who was a Member of Parliament here, a Roman Catholic man, saying, Maybe I Do, in which he produces the same kinds of information and statistics exactly on Australia. And the Australian statistics, the American statistics, apart from a couple of wrinkles, like the subject of African Americans, we don't have the same kind of racial issues as the African Americans. We have them much more like the Native Americans. The Indigenous Americans are like our Indigenous Australians, but the African American situation is a different thing. There's that wrinkle, but otherwise it's the same in Australia as it is in America. Indeed, Kevin Andrew, when he was in Parliament, had a committee he set up which reported back to the government. It's called To Have and To Hold, Strategies to Strengthen Marriage Relationships, because they worked out that it was several billion dollars worth of cost to the Australian economy, which is, money is the only thing that politicians understand, because that affects votes. And so it could actually tell you how much it's costing us as a community to have free and easy marriage family relationships, because the costs that come when you have people suffering this great list of consequences is very great.
It's a terrific cost and burden on our society, and of course the people involved in it are often not the ones who pay the cost. The man who runs off with another man's wife and they go overseas, they by and large don't pick up the cost that they have delivered to their children. It's a terrible cost that the society then winds up picking up, but not very well. Here's a young couple. I only know their first names, and even then I can't remember. I've got to look it up here. Brad and Maureen. So you can tell they're your age a little while ago, can't you? Yes, it was a little while ago, because here's what they look like in their prime. They married in 1951, and there they are, a happily married couple afterwards. Now I'm going to show you something about them that you'll never be able to produce by a government report, you'll never be able to produce by any social welfare institution that you ever create, because God's one is marriage, and it is enormously powerful. See, they live over at Manly now, where their kids are living as adults, and Maureen's got dementia. So they go and sit down at Manly, down the Corso, down the beach most days. He takes her down there, but he found that she's got no long-term memory, but she likes engaging with people. But because of what she looks like, no one will talk to her. So he's invented a T-shirt. My beautiful wife has dementia. Please say hello to her. And now people are doing that as they step by. By the time you walked away from them, she won't remember the conversation, but you've made her day by saying hello to her. How do you create that kind of care for another person? See, that's what marriage can do. That's what marriage should do. When we say for better, for worse, in sickness and in health, they meant it. And because they meant it, now I think they... Oh, I've forgotten now which year they married. Because they meant it, all these days later, she's being looked after by him in a really loving way, isn't it? Now, that's so thoughtful, so kind. If you're down Manly way and you see them, make sure you do talk to her, won't you? But so many people have liked it that the shop that produced his T-shirt have had lots of orders now for similar kinds of things. You see, marriage is good for people. Family is good for people. Has all kinds of very important consequences. But our society, having turned its back on God, has turned its back on marriage. And now we're turning our back on children as well. Because not only are we warehousing children in daycare and long daycare, even when they're babies, but we're not having children either. We're not replacing ourselves. Because we've lost confidence in humanity. We've lost confidence in life. It's a very sad state that our society is coming to turning away from God, because no government social welfare program is going to be able to look after you when you're old and in dementia. But a spouse will. That's the difference. But it's not just when you're old and in dementia. All the way through life, when you're going through the struggles of life and the stress of life in your mid-40s, when you're raising the children together, when you're saving for the house, that interpersonal relationship is just such an important, powerful factor in the way to live. It's how we should do it. But seeing the society is in such a mess, and seeing you need to be prayed for as well, Percy's going to come and talk to us about praying, or pray, lead us in prayer about family life tonight, eh?
Our loving Heavenly Father, we thank you for your beautiful design of men and women and the families that you create from them, that they produce so much stability and happiness both within and without. And we thank you also that we can live in a country that was founded upon families and that enjoys relative peace. But Father, we lament the brokenness of even our most stable families, that as we see the joys that they can bring, we can see the harm we do to one another those closest to us. We lament our society's continued breakdown of the family unit and the way that this affects people on all levels, across classes, across races, and how it particularly affects the most vulnerable among us. Please heal our world, our country, and our families by the gospel. May your love spread throughout them, and may we grow in our understanding of who you are and what you are like, so that we can be like you and like the Lord Jesus to one another. Please bring those in our families who don't know the Lord Jesus to come and rest in him. And please, as we, for those of us who are married and those who are thinking about marriage, help us to make wise and good choices that will uphold and protect our families and whatever role we play in them, and that we would also be a support to all the families around us, that we would support others in their marriages as well. And we ask this in your Son's name. Amen.
Thank you, brother. Some time ago, I wrote on this topic an essay. Now I'm not getting there at all. What's going wrong with me? And so that's written there. There's a, I don't know why it's grey and white, but there you go. If you go into philipjensen.com and you go to resources, there's a series of articles. One's on happiness on trial. Has utilitarianism failed? And it's about the family life. It came from receiving that report, reading it carefully, analysing it in the light of what non-Christians, especially one particular atheist, had taught in the sexual revolution, which is now being seen by more and more people to have failed, dismally. But when I wrote that, they didn't see it. I wrote it about 20 years ago. I've read it again this week, and 20 years ago I knew a lot. Don't know where it's gone since, but that's why I refer you to it. Okay. There are generational, intergenerational sins. What do we do about them if they are there? I mean, you can see there are consequences generationally. The parents you come from, they're the consequence of their parents. And so your children will be the consequences of you. And so over time, families grow and flourish, or families split and divide and destroy. And so there are consequences, but are consequences the same as sin? So here's a set of questions for you to work on with each other now. Are there intergenerational sins and guilt as well as consequences? And that is, are there corporate sins and guilt? We heard Romans 1-4 was talking about individual sins and guilt. Thank you, Gloria, for that. But are there also corporate sins, corporate guilt? And if so, do we need to apologise or make atonement or pay reparations? And if that's the case, for how many generations do we need to do it? You see the set of questions? Very live issues today on a whole range of issues. The slavery trade, the West Indians are demanding reparations from the British. The Indigenous Australians would like reparations from the European colonisers here. Is that a right thing? Is it a wrong thing? Is it your fault? Is it your parents' fault and your grandparents? Do I carry their sins? Talk with each other. Okay, let's the first question is a really... First question's a simple yes, no. So hand up those groups that said yes to the first question. Yes, there are intergenerational sins. Hands up the groups that said no. Hands up the groups who are undecided as a group. Yeah, it's a real tricky one, isn't it? Well, the second question is not much different, you see. Are there corporate sins and guilt? Hands up those who think there is, yes, corporate sins. Good-o. What about no's? Any got no? Okay, and any undecided? Okay.
Assuming that you're involved in a corporate sin, your company is destroying the environment, right? There's a corporate sin. You're poisoning people because of what you're doing in your economic gain. Do we need to apologise, make atonement, or pay reparations? Let's start off. What do you think we need to do?
In that circumstance? Don't know. Didn't think about it.
Okay. That's a good answer, yes. Apologise and make repayments, yes? All three, yes? You'd say yes on all three. It's the third question. Do we need to apologise, make atonement? And... Yeah? All three. Hands up those who are all three. Oh, okay. Some are not. Okay. What are we on here? We didn't discuss it.
Depends how you define the term we.
Yes, there's the problem with corporate, isn't it? How much am I responsible for the corporation that I'm involved in? Yes? Go on, what else? What do you think? On the question of the company that you're a part of that has just destroyed the local environment and poisoned a million people, do you think you should apologise, make atonements or pay reparations? Depends on your accountability. Okay. Here is really complicated, isn't it? And, of course, the last one, there's a real problem, isn't it? See, if you think conquering a land is something that you should pay reparations for later, how many generations? Should the French pay reparations to the English for the Norman conquest in 1066? Should the Danes pay reparation to the Scots for the Viking invasion that took place in, I don't even know the date, that was that far back. It was before I went to school, so I don't know. So, it's 200 and whatever it is years ago that white people landed here in Australia. Is it still an area where we should be paying reparations? Or is it time has passed now, we don't do? Very hard to answer those questions, isn't it? Let me ask you a simpler one for your group to discuss quickly. All right? Very quickly now. Should we pull down statues and change place names? Should we pull down statues because we don't like the people that the statues are or what they did, etc., and change the place names of places because the people who did, whose names they're after, are dreadful people, and so we change the names? Quickly work with each other on this. Try and get a group answer from each group. Well, of course, there's no single answer to this one. We'll again have massive of opinions. So think of yourselves in terms of debating and come up with the reasons. Right? So what are the reasons for pulling them down that you would think? Leave aside the reasons against. What are the reasons for pulling them down?
They did something you don't like anymore.
They did something you don't like anymore. They did a big sin, yes? Yes?
Like, if they don't symbolise our values now.
If they don't symbolise our values now, their statues, yes?
If they have caused damage to the current day.
If they've caused damage to the current day, yes?
Idolatry.
It's an idolatry, yes?
We put up the wrong man,
yes? No, we Okay, any other reasons why we should pull them down?
Moral progress.
Moral progress. Yes, it's a common one. They're war criminals. So shouldn't you have a statue for war criminals? Why not? You've got something against war criminals. You're not inclusivist, are you? Yes? Okay, start giving me the reasons against pulling them down.
They're a part of history.
Yeah, that's why we should leave the statues for Adolf Hitler up.
Well, it's like, you learn from history, right? Like, you learn from the mistakes you made in the past. Taking them down may not actually fix things, because people feel like, I'm not being represented, the things that happened to me aren't represented.
Yes, yes. That's right. It's a form of censorship, isn't it? Of speech, yes. Good. You're trying to be like God and judge right and wrong if you do it, yes?
Your lines start blurring.
Your lines start blurring.
Who you
pair down, who you keep up becomes a difficult choice. Yeah? Sorry? And who are you to judge morally this other person, yes? People have different opinions, yes? History is important. Good. Yes? No?
Nothing further to add.
That's a good way, yes?
At what point does its replacement become considered wrong?
At what point does the replacement itself become considered wrong and we put them back up again? Yeah? One of the ones I'm interested in is Rhodes, Cecil Rhodes, who gives the Rhodes scholarships because of the money he ripped out of South Africa. And he now has, for the last, I don't know, 50-100 years, there have been people pouring to Oxford University on Rhodes scholarships. Right? Because of his views of South Africa and his actions, there's been terrific pressure to pull his statue down, and people are renaming the Rhodes scholarship and things like that. But, of course, they're still taking the money. The Rhodes scholars want the Rhodes statue to come down while they live on the Rhodes money. There's certain hypocrisy comes into some of these things, isn't it? So here's some of the ones that have come down in the United States. There's poor old Christopher Columbus kissing the earth. He should never have come, should he, as different people. And they're in the UK. They're slave owners on the top left, isn't it? That's King Leopold down in the bin here. Leopold's one of the most hideous men in human history. What he did to the Congo was just unbelievable. But you can go to Australia. You know, there's Captain Cook. People want to remove him and change him. There's Governor Macquarie. Should we take down Governor Macquarie? He was the first man who really saw this wasn't just a penal colony, but this could be a great nation. But he's the only governor who had in his own household a slave from India. So it's the only slave ownership we actually technically know in Australian history. But there's Robert Towns, from which we get Townsville, and he's the man who bought over the islanders, Blackbird, it was called, to get them to be worked virtually in slavery. It wasn't called slavery, but that's actually what it was. But the whole Townsville is named after the man who introduced one of the most hideous parts of Australia. Should we pull him down? Rename Townsville? Jensenville or something? What? Changing names of places, you know? Leningrad actually was St. Petersburg before, and once the communists fell in, they went back to being St. Petersburg. Who do we want to honour and why? It is very tricky. I like the argument you're using, myself, about history, but you can understand the problems. So, should we pull down Chain Slate? Are some cultures, because this is one of the things that came up, well done, anticipating where we're going, are some cultures morally superior to others? Can you judge the immorality of a past culture? Even cultures themselves, are they amoral? Do they evolve morally? Or do cultures not actually change? Cultures are the thing that holds change back? Or are cultures only ever changed by external forces coming upon them, like being conquered or something like that? Take a moment to talk about the judgment of others. Because when you start pulling statues down, that's judgment, isn't it? When you start writing history and saying, well, this is a bad, but what I just said about Mr. Towns, well, that was my judgment from here,
his judgment from his place, this was opening up North Queensland. He was doing a good thing for the town. In fact, the town so loved him for the wealth that came in as a result of his enterprise that they put a statue up for him, which today people want to pull down. So can you judge events of history? There you go. Mind stretching tonight, isn't it? Okay, I'm missing people in the middle, so how we start here? Are some cultures morally superior to others? You're unsure?
Yes.
100%. Good. Sam's culture is superior to Fletcher's and all kinds of people, yes? Yes, how do you judge a culture? Because it's sometimes just one man, you know? Was it Hitler or was it the Germans, yes?
I think that like someone to leave their
So people want to leave a legacy, but are they wrong or right in doing it?
So
just is. Sometimes selfish, yes? Don't know. So there are cultures, within cultures there can be judgment of cultures, can't there? Yes?
If we're divided against ourselves, how are we going to judge?
But if we can't judge ourselves without conflict, we can't really judge in the past much, can we? Yes?
We said that you can, rather than judging cultures, it's more individual based and everyone.
So you can't judge cultures, it's just individuals that we would be judging. That be right? Hello. Here's a new group that's joined us, isn't it? I won't mention that you're late. What's your answer?
Yes.
Good. Yes, what? There are some cultures that are morally superior, and you can't judge the immorality of. And which one?
Yes, probably B.
B. Okay. All right, let's move to this last question. Sorry? Yes, it's easier to have a solution when there's only... hands up those who are on A, B, C, D. Hands up the A's. Your group hasn't discussed it, just put your own hands up. Hands up the A's, that cultures are amoral. No? Okay, B, that they evolve morally. C, that they never change. D, that they only change by external forces. E, don't know. Yeah, all this stuff is fairly mind-bending, isn't it, really? Because it's very hard to get the clear-cut, yes, this is the truth, or no. But, frankly, friends, some of this is pretty easy. Some are. Are some cultures morally superior to others? Yes. It has never worried me in the slightest that the British stopped the practice of suti in India, whereby widows were put onto their husband's funeral pyre because they didn't want to deal with widows and have them dependents everywhere. So when your husband died, you were burnt to death with him. I think that's wrong. And I don't have much trouble saying it's wrong. And I'm glad that the British Empire stopped it. I think it's very evil. But I've got some others as well. Female genital mutilation. I think that's wrong too. And there are cultures in North Africa which practice it. And I think it's a very evil thing to do to poor young girls and for women. I think cannibalism is wrong. And so when the colonisers came to the Pacific Islands particularly, cannibalism was everywhere. And I'm glad they stopped it. I think cannibalism's a dreadful thing. When Europeans went to South America, they discovered child sacrifice. I think that's an evil too. I don't think you should offer up children so that the sun will rise and be happy with you today. If you believe in myths like that, you do terrible evils.
And there are cultures that are superior to other cultures. I really find it difficult to go along with cultural relativism. As if, you know, I know it is true, every culture works to produce what they think is best for their society. And so you can see how burning widows meant they didn't have to worry too much about pensions. We've got to worry about pensions. I think it's superior to worry about pensions and keep widows alive. I don't have a great difficulty of working that one out, frankly. The fact that, yes, there is a cultural advantage in doing what they're doing, I think, is an irrelevance. And once you accept that there are some, even extreme, of, you know, everything I've said so far is pretty extreme, isn't it? But even if there's, once you've acknowledged there is some things that are morally wrong, in an absolutist sense, that the fact that it's a culture does not excuse it. It's just wrong. And if that's what the culture teaches, the culture needs to change. Once you accept that, then what we're doing is arguing about which things are wrong, which things need to change. Because we've accepted that some cultures are superior to others. But how do they change? Well, they can evolve morally, but very slowly and very rarely. Because cultures, by and large, are ways in which people make a society function effectively. And so the very nature of culture is to create stability. And so culture rarely changes. It's a microcosm change when it does evolve at all. And so you can't say never change, but the evolution is very, very slow. So how they get changed? They get changed by external forces, that's how. By colonisers, by war, by genocides, all kinds of ways like that which are external. But of course the big external change that I know about that really has made a huge difference for the good, because quite often the warfares and the colonisations, you're just changing one bad culture for another. Leopold in the Belgium, you know, he didn't improve the state of the Congo. He made it almost infinitely worse. The Congo is a basket case to this day, rift in civil war because of that man and the way he treated the Congolese. So sometimes it can be worse, the external force, but the great external force that makes a difference for the good is the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ. Once that hits a culture, things change. Not immediately, sometimes with progression. You know, it took some years to get rid of the slave trade. 50, 60 years to fight out the slave trade issue. But once done, then that spread across the rest of the world bit by bit, so that there's hardly any formal slavery today, although there's lots of informal slavery still available. But it was the Christians who made that change. Working hours for children, or working at all for children. Universal education. You know, in the early 19th century here in Australia, or in Sydney as it was then, basically, in the 1830s, 1840s, more than 50% of the children were illiterate because they hadn't gone to school. Why do we get everybody going to school and literate? Because the Christian church has pushed for it and argued for it and changed the nature of the society as a result. You see, change does come. The great external change for good is God. I don't like changing names. I don't like pulling down statues for the history reasons as you guys mentioned. I think you're right. You pull down the statue of the terrible man, then how will we ever know the terrible man ever existed? You see, it's the Chinese government will not allow any memorial to Tiananmen Square. It doesn't exist. Because it did exist. And it was a dreadful thing. But it doesn't exist in Chinese consciousness, because you're not allowed to put up a statue or have a memorial to it in any shape. Censorship, historical censorship is really bad. Statues are idolatry. Idolatry is to great men. That's a problem, isn't it? But I came across a train station in Paris that I
really would change the name. It's very hard to live in the suburb of Stalingrad in Paris. But I have friends who did, so I went and visited them and got off the station at Stalingrad. And, yeah, I think I'd change that one, frankly. We're going to have a break in a moment or two, but James is going to tell us some things that we need to know about.